This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about higher education with a focus on how the traditional university experience may be changing forever. And I'm joined by Larry Bacow, former president of Tufts University, and Joseph Ayoun, president of Northeastern University. And Larry Bacow, I'm going to play a little clip for you from a conversation I had with former Yahoo vice president Seth Godin. He was concerned about how education is being structured right now. And here he is talking about what college he thinks has become and the accreditation problem that we were talking about before. Let's listen.
Most people is just high school, but with more binge drinking involved and debt. And it's just polishing the industrial system. The challenge that we have is the accreditation problem, that it's one thing to teach people. It's another thing to prove that they learned something. And so what you pay for now at a four-year institution is not the courses, because you can get the courses for free. What you pay for is proof that you finished. And at famous institutions, for example, in Boston, that proof is worth more than at unknown institutions that don't have good football teams in the Midwest. And so what we have to do is figure out a shorthand that will enable people to prove what they know. And that's, you know, I'm way out on a limb when I write about this, but I think most talented people do not and should not have a resume. What they should have is a list of projects. What have they built? Who have they impacted? Who is so in love with their work that they will speak up on their behalf?
Larry Bacow, I mean, one of the interesting questions here is if you take online courses and you learn a lot and you learn how to, you know, code on the computer, how do you show people that you know that if you haven't been to a Northeastern, to a Tufts, to an MIT and graduated and you've got the piece of paper?
So online education has in some ways only made it easier for people to access content in some ways. But to a first approximation, content has always been available for free as long as we've had libraries. You know, I could go into any library in the country and I could check out Paul Samuelson's economics text. I could check out George Thomas's calculus text. I could check out exactly the same texts that were being used in the great universities around the country. And I could, if I wanted to and I was diligent, I could master the material on my own. And many people did that. Not many. Some people did that. But as I think you observe, being able to demonstrate to people that you understand the material, that you're capable of applying it, is more than just mastering the material. I think, personally, interesting things happen when you confine faculty and students under temperature and pressure for the 4 years that constitutes college. And I think it is more than just reading a textbook. I think it is more than just learning and understanding the material. So, yes, while it's true that if one can demonstrate competence in certain areas, that ought to be enough. Judgment is not necessarily competence. And I always like to ask people who sort of say, well, gee, if people can show in a test that they can know the material, shouldn't that be enough? And to that, I always say, let me ask you a question. When you hire people, do you interview them or do you just make your judgment based upon what you see on the written record? And the answer is no, people actually want to meet with people. Something happens when people are together. And it happens in the classroom. It happens on the campus. It happens in the workplace. So I think it's more than just a set of an ability to demonstrate that one can write code.
So if just learning, online, listening to great lectures, absorbing what the people say, if that's not enough, how do you reconcile that with the money problem, which I know you think is a problem? I read an interview where you said that in 1969, you remember protests at MIT where people had signs that said $2,150 is too damn much.
Right.
And the people thought, well, this can't keep going on. And, well, it did, right? So how do you reconcile those two things? If you need to be at an MIT, but it's incredibly hard for people to afford, what do you do?
Well, I do think, as I said earlier, in the past, we've always had lower cost ways of people getting an education. Some of the great minds in this country graduated from places like CCNY, for example. at very, very low cost at the time. And
City still College of New York.
And yeah. still graduate from CUNY in New York today. And other great, you know, public urban institutions that are non-residentially based institutions. It's a different education than what one would get at a Northeastern or a Tufts, but it's still an excellent education. And one of the great things about this country is that we've not stratified education in ways as it exists in some other places, that if you don't go to one of only a handful of institutions, that your career and your future is materially different from those who did. Not true in the U.S. I do think the traditional institutions have tremendous pressure right now to think about how can they provide what is known as a traditional education more efficiently at lower cost? How can they bend the cost curve? And I do think that the same tools that allow the Courseras of the world to reach out directly to students, and that's the bulk of the 2 million students currently taking Coursera courses, are not enrolled in a college or university in the traditional sense now. Those same tools are going to enable the institutions to teach their own students locally more efficiently. That will help to lower the cost.
I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH Boston Public Radio, and we're talking about the future of higher education, whether there's a revolution going on, with Larry Bacow, former president of Tufts, and Joseph Ayoun, current president of Northeastern. And Joseph Ayoun, you wanted to get in here.
Yeah, I think the issue you raised before when we listened to the segment is the issue of output. You know, so far in many ways, higher education has focused on input measures, how selective we are, the SAT scores, etc. And then, in addition now, given the pressure coming at us in terms of cost, in terms of MOOCs, etc., we have to start looking at how to justify the value of being in an institution such as Northeastern or Tufts, as Larry said. Therefore, it's going to force us now to clarify and be very clear about the value proposition, and which means the output measures too, from this perspective. And, you know, and in addition, it's going to force us to differentiate ourselves. Why should I come to Northeastern? Why should I go to Tufts? Why, MIT, Harvard, whatever it is that you want. Now, higher education in many ways also, in addition, we have created a dichotomy between teaching students how to live and how to earn a living. And now, given the expectations of that the students have and society has, we have to start merging the two together. Employers, for instance, from this perspective, want students to really be ready to face the world, not face only a particular discipline, but the world as a whole. So globalization is going to be important. Students have to be globally aware. Students have to have an experiential approach to education where they are going out, testing their learning while they are students. That's, for instance, what we do. So it is forcing us now not to focus only on input measures. I'm talking about higher education in general, but on output measures. By the time you leave, what is your profile? What have you gained? What is a Northeastern education? What is a Tufts education?
So a little bit of the Seth Godin model of like, what are your projects? What have you actually accomplished? Not just the piece of paper.
Yeah, but I agree. But also, in some ways, it's not enough to have those projects. But because ultimately, as Larry said, you can be involved in multiple projects. But what is the outcome of all these activities? Who are you now? Are you ready to face the world? Are you ready to be at ease in Shanghai as you are in Boston? Are you ready to take this job? And this is, you know, it's not enough. Projects by themselves are not enough. It's the integration of this classroom experience and the world experience that is going to make you a whole person. And that's what we ultimately, education is all about.
I'm interested in what both of you think about this, but I wonder in 10, 20, maybe even 30 years, do you think if the bar gets higher for sort of regular institutions, the sort of brick and mortar institutions, is it possible that the ranks of colleges are going to be thinned within 10, 20, 30 years because people are going to be diverted doing online work and other things?
So I honestly believe that anybody who tells you they know where this is going to wind up is blowing smoke.
Hmm.
Nobody really knows. One of the interesting things, again, about higher education in the United States is it's also unbelievably competitive. And I'm not talking about to get into. I'm talking about how the institutions compete with each other. We compete for students, we compete for faculty, we compete for staff, we compete for resources, we compete for mind share, we compete for everything. That competition breeds innovation. And you will see different institutions adopting different strategies. And some will succeed, and those who don't are going to try and copy them as quickly as they can. I actually think the institutions are far more durable than most people give them credit for being. And that, yes, some institutions will disappear, but that's always been true. We've always had institutions that come and go. But you will still see many of the traditional institutions. And I also would tell you that the major public universities in this country will be around precisely because the legislatures that have supported them have an interest in seeing that they continue. One thing which never gets talked about in this conversation, never, is the fact that research and education are actually a joint product, and that the same institutions that are criticized for escalating costs in the way in which they educate their students are also the same institutions, in many cases, the research universities that are generating new knowledge and new technologies that are spawning new companies that are helping to reinvigorate the economy. We can't afford to lose the latter. And the latter is necessarily married to the former. So.
Okay. Well, now, I mean, I don't want to argue that there's any shortage of people who want to go to these elite institutions or that many of them are having any trouble with money, because that's probably not true for a lot of them. But, you know, before you were president of Tufts, you were also you were an administrator at MIT. And you've talked about how the pressure was generally never to lower costs. It was reduce class sizes, make sure there was more interaction, make sure that labs were better. See what you could do to really make that MIT experience better. Except if that's forever the pressure, We still have this incredibly escalating cost curve, which doesn't seem to speak to what you were saying before about, well, let's simplify, and in that way, we can make this accessible to more people.
All of the competitive pressures actually push institutions to do more. As I like to say, what we're very good at doing is doing more with more. I do think, though, that as the world has changed, we're going to have to figure out how to do more with at least what we have today. And I think that's healthy pressure. And I'm an optimist. I believe the institutions can rise to this occasion. And we're seeing some very, very interesting experiments right now. And as I said, it's a competitive marketplace. And those institutions that figure out how to do it better are going to steal a march on their competition. And the competition is going to be watching them very closely and scrambling to try and copy and steal everything that they do.
President Joseph Ayun, I wonder two things. One is, do you think in 10, 20 years the ranks of brick-and-mortar colleges will be thinned? And the second is, when we talk about innovation, do you look around the world and say, well, America's doing okay, but here are some countries I would point to that are doing some very interesting things that we should keep an eye on?
Yeah. To answer your first question, yes, I believe that there are institutions that will disappear. Some are disappearing now. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a pressure, unfortunately, on some small liberal arts colleges. But the answer is yes.
Just because they can't find enough people who can spend $50,000, $60,000 a year.
Yes. And also, you know, the pendulum is swinging going back to what Larry said. Students want to be involved not only in absorbing knowledge, but knowledge creation. And that gives the research universities an edge, because the students can be there, can be involved in research. Now, in terms of what's happening worldwide, I think that we can expect, since your question is 20, 30 years from now, we can expect a phenomenon that is referred to as reverse innovation. Innovation in the United States, we have been very fortunate in not coupling innovation with cost, saying we are innovating, and sometimes we're innovating without any consideration of cost. We are seeing that this formula cannot apply to a place like India, that where you have people, you know, that want to access higher education, 500 million within 10 years. That's the goal of the Indian government. They cannot use our approach to education. So you are going to see, and there are attempts now. When I visited India, I visited some of the for-profits and not-for-profits, and there are attempts to have massive delivery of online education at a lower cost, but also adaptable. You know, it is not enough like the, you know, the Coursera's, Udacity's, etc. When it comes to science, etc., that's fine. You can look at it. But then when you look at history, when you look at political science, when you look at environmental issues, you want to be adaptable to the region you are in. And I foresee that we are going to see, and we are seeing innovations happening in the emerging world, that and it's a completely different paradigm than the one we have, because simply they cannot afford not, you know, a tenth of what we have. Therefore, they are going to be pressured to innovate and provide new models. And I think this is very interesting. We're seeing the emergence of that.
Larry Bacow, do you worry about what you see overseas? The New York Times just looked at China and how the Chinese government is pouring a ton of money in to making sure that, you know, millions more people get educated. And we certainly used to be number one in terms of educating people, higher education. It's now South Korea. What do you see in terms of our ability to compete with other countries when it comes to higher education?
Well, you know, I still think that, you know, despite all of our faults, American higher education is the envy of the rest of the world. If you ask any other country if they would exchange their higher education system with ours, I can't think of a single one that wouldn't grab what we have in a heartbeat. And if you take a look at any of the rankings of the world's, you know, greatest universities, a disproportionate share of them are U.S. institutions. So, you know, we do know how to do something right here. We will face more competition. In some ways, we're a victim of our own success because we've educated the leaders of many of these great institutions abroad. And they are taking what they've learned here. They're adapting it locally. We have U.S. institutions that are helping them. I think we should be doing that. We live in a global economy, and ultimately it is in the interest of the United States to see the rest of the world become better educated. As they become better educated, there will be more markets for our goods and services in the U.S. as well. Also, we continue to be the sink at the end of the rest of the world's brain drain, because many of the countries in the rest of the world continue to send their best and their brightest to school in the United States, and they never leave. Many of these students never leave. In the process, they enrich our economy. So it's you ask an interesting and a complicated question. I wish I had a simple answer for you. I agree with Joseph. There will be new models developed in other parts of the world. They will be uniquely adapted to the circumstances that exist in those parts of the world. No doubt we will learn something from them just as they are learning something from us. That's what it means to live in a globally interconnected world.
A very interesting conversation in terms of what's coming next for higher education. Thanks for joining me. I'm Larry Bacow, former president of Tufts University, and Joseph Ayun, the current president of Northeastern University. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And Callie Crossley back in the studio. Hey, Callie.
Kara, what's coming next is what's happening now for so many people who are over 50 and jobless, and they have a college education, many of them. It's a tough scene. We're going to talk about what it means and how it's changing both social norms and really retirement forever.
I look forward to hearing it. I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.